All right. Good morning. My name is Tim, if I haven't met you. I'm one of the interns here at Artisan, and I'm glad to be with you here today. So last week, my fellow intern David gave a brief slideshow of his life, so I thought I'd share one too. Next slide. So I've been in Vancouver for the last 2 years. I currently work at Union Gospel Mission just down the road as a supervisor of volunteer resources. I live in Mount Pleasant with three roommates, two human ones, Sydney and Blythe, who you see there. And then also the most adorable dog ever, Ruby. Come on, let's go. Oh, she's so cute. But contrary to popular belief, I am not from Chicago. I was born in Winnipeg. I moved to Barrie, Ontario when I was 5 and grew up there. Then turning 18, I decided I wanted to pursue pastoral ministry, so I attended a small Bible college in Chicago. Somehow I ended up there, staying there for 7 years as I completed a master's in theology, and hot take, it's the best city in America, and I won't hear otherwise. One of my favorite activities in Chicago is wandering through our art museums. I love just sitting with a piece of artwork and letting it speak back to me. Something I've appreciated over time has been the way that art can be an act of justice. And one piece that I can't shake from my mind is this painting titled Black Squares that I found in the Chicago Museum of Contemporary Art. Unfortunately, I couldn't find it anywhere on the internet. But on the canvas were 16 separately painted black squares, arranged in a 4x4 pattern. No square was the same, each varying in tone, opacity, and shade. But the point of the art piece was that it was a parody of the Blackout Tuesday movement that happened in the summer of 2020. If you recall, Blackout Tuesday arose out of the murder of African American George Floyd. In response, Instagram was flooded with black squares in solidarity with the black community. Unfortunately, it caused detrimental harm by unintentionally silencing black voices and replacing it with the noise of performative allyship in the form of black squares. The 16 black squares represented lost black voices amidst a sea of people attempting to show that they supported the oppressed cause. I'll be the first to admit that I posted a black square while there were protests for George Floyd just 2 blocks from my school in Chicago. This painting still haunts me today because it's a reminder of the thin ways that we can stand with those on the margins. But I believe that there's a better response out there. When I think about our current political and social climate, I'm overwhelmed. I don't have to mention the political, social, and economic elephants in the room because, frankly, there are too many. But what do we do? Vox magazine puts its dilemma well in that we can't do everything, we can't do nothing, but we must do something. We must do something. But what is that something? So we've been going through a series called The Cross, Reimagining Death. And in this series, we see that there's more than one way to see the cross. By looking at the cross in multiple ways, this doesn't mean that we invalidate a certain view or put one above another. Rather, we hope to invite you to see the different angles of the cross and how all of it can be good news. Last week, David shared about the contrast of the two paths. Is this better? Well, yeah, now I can hear myself better. I thought I was pretty loud already. Okay. So last week, David talked about the contrast of two paths. So the way of violence and nonviolence. He showed us that at the cross, we see a window of who God truly is, one who refuses to succumb to violence. This nonviolent posture helps us navigate a world that wants to act violently and seize power, trusting in the power of God to intervene. But this week, I want to build upon this idea further and to ask the question, in light of the suffering we see around the world, how does Jesus respond? And how do we, as followers of Jesus, likewise, respond in ways of nonviolent peace? And I think that the answer that we is that we must lean into the practice of co-suffering, or as we call it today, solidarity. With the fleshless answer out, I invite you to jump into our gospel story this morning. So let's go there now. So you'll see this on page 737 of your chair Bibles, beginning in Luke chapter 23, verses 26 to 31. As the soldiers led him away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the childless women, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry?" So here in Luke 23, we encounter Jesus on his journey to the cross, exhausted to his breaking point. It's a cryptic scene with a lot going on. But to help simplify this text, I want to break the story down by looking at three parties involved in this scene: Jesus, Simon, and the weeping women. Each has a unique viewpoint to share that will paint a larger picture of what co-suffering entails for us. So let's start with the onlooking women. Who are these women? Luke doesn't tell us, but this community of tears plays an important role in Jesus's journey to his death. In this gospel, Luke contrasts the absent and fearful disciples with these women who courageously followed Jesus from his arrest and trial all the way to his bitter end. But in response to their tears, Jesus gives a startling message, asking these women not to weep for him, but for themselves and for their children, because great evil will come over the land to the point that what was considered a blessing, having children, will now be seen as a curse. And people will be clamoring for destruction, alluding to the fall of Jerusalem, which actually happens 40 years later. Jesus prophesies that things will get much worse for these women and the rest of Jerusalem. Even after his own death, the innocent will still be murdered. The meek will be oppressed by the powerful. The proud will continue to triumph over the humble. It seems like a hopeless message, and I can't help but think that Jesus' words are not too far off from today. In our increasingly digitized world, things haven't really changed. We cycle through online articles, and we scroll through social media feeds, and we just see bad news. We can even walk a few blocks around our city or even in this neighborhood here and feel at a loss for hope. Or maybe we've shut it out altogether because we cannot hold the weight. And I am with you there too. I constantly see myself being pulled to either extreme, facing the pressures of despair on one side and burnout and apathy on the other. But in the midst of this madness, I find it fascinating that Jesus calls these women to weep. Instead of calling his disciples to act or fight, he calls his people to grieve. Why is that? Describing lament, Korean-American theologian Sung Chung Ra describes lament as the language of suffering. Lament recognizes the struggles of life and cries out for injustice against existing injustices. So rather than choosing to numb or ignore the pain that we find in front of us, lament challenges us to speak honestly. Lament is also prophetic work because it challenges us to declare that the status quo is not normal. So this brings us to our first point, that true solidarity is weeping for the injustices of our neighbors. In this public act of grieving, these women are moved by injustice to mourn, and we see the effect twofold. Firstly, it's a commitment to the suffering, that they're not alone, that though we may not be in the oppressed shoes, we take on the heartbreak with them. And for both the suffering and those in solidarity, there is both power and comfort in a community grieving together, naming the injustice, and asking the Creator to intervene. But also by lamenting, we are publicly proclaiming to the broader community the injustices of the marginalized. In our story, there's no one else weeping but these women. But by being the only ones mourning, it's not a cry of hysteria, but a declaration that something is not right. These women amplify the sufferings of Jesus in their lament, showing to everyone that his death sentence is unjust. Speaking in 2016, in the wake of the murders of two Black men in America, Black feminist Roxane Gay wrote, "Black people do not need allies. We need people to stand up and take on the problems born of oppression as their own, without remove or distance. We need people to do this even if they cannot fully understand what it's like to be oppressed for their race or ethnicity, gender, sexuality, ability, class, religion, or other marker of identity." Think lament is that practice of the church that forces us to sit with the suffering and listen to their stories to understand. It forces us not to gloss over the pain or attempt to give neat answers to complex questions. Rather, it challenges us to look at the injustice in the eye and declare what it truly is in its ugliest form. Lament allows us to hold on to suffering honestly, to develop compassion and empathy rather than callousness, and to hold on to hope rather than despair. One powerful practice, example of this practice of communal lament was our Ash Wednesday service. Using the ashes of Verdant Greece from this community, the staff team burned these ashes and used them to mark our foreheads during the service. And for us as staff, and for us as a wider community, we might not have known who wrote what, or fully even understand the extent of the grief written on these papers. But the point is that the grief was worth grieving for. And by marking their laments as ashes on our foreheads, it's a tangible symbol that suffering is never held alone, but as a community, together. Let's move closer and see this event from Simon's perspective. So Jesus can't carry the cross on his own. He needs help. And this is where we meet Simon of Cyrene, who is forced by the Roman soldiers to take on the burden of the cross with Jesus. Now, does anyone know anything about Simon? No? Well, that's a trick question because frankly, we don't know that much about him. But here's what we can infer about him. So he's from Cyrene, or modern day Libya, which is about 1800 kilometers away from Jerusalem. And to be able to travel that far in ancient times required wealth and status. Yet here he is forced to carry the cross of Jesus by imperial Roman authorities. It's a wrenching interruption to Simon's plan to worship in the city with thousands of others, but it's a task that he dutifully takes on. Doing my research of this passage, I stumbled upon an icon of Simon done by Catholic priest Seeger Coder. Sorry about that pronunciation. But I'll give you a moment to take this in and to let it just speak to you. I love the way that Jesuit priest Theo Schmidt-Kahns describes this artwork. Closely connected, together they carry the heavy beam of the cross, hardly distinguishable from each other. One holds onto the other with a warm embrace. One pulls the other along. The two become one in their suffering. Strangers unexpectedly become brothers. Jesus and Simon look at us as if they wanted to say, "We have a dream, a vision, the fraternal world of tomorrow. No one carries their cross alone anymore. Nobody despises the stranger. Everyone accepts the other, the Palestinians, the Jews, the German, the foreigner, the Christian, the Muslim, because everyone is sisters and brothers, because he, Jesus, is the brother of all of us." So in the face of suffering and oppression, we see the creation of community where neither Jesus nor Simon are alone. So where empire wields suffering as a tool to isolate, Jesus shows us that in the face of oppression is the call to come together. So this leads us to our second point, that true solidarity means leaning into the practice of community. If you can just like think about the dynamics at play just for a moment. So Simon is rich, Jesus is poor. Simon is foreign, Jesus is local. Simon is a worshiper, where Jesus is a rabbi. Simon is able-bodied, where Jesus is physically incapable of carrying the cross. There's plenty of crossing intersections here, but yet there's a bond formed when Simon shares the cross with Jesus. When we stand in solidarity with the marginalized, there's always a crossing of boundaries where we must be conscious of our own power, our class, our gender, our race, and more. But in this picture of solidarity, there's a powerful image when seemingly two opposing people stand together in the face of injustice. On the side of the privileged, there's the invitation to relinquish power, status, and control to stand with the marginalized. But on the side of the marginalized, there's still agency, the choice to trust the other, to share their perspective, and to be leaders in their own liberation. So when mutuality and respect are established in solidarity, we see that in light of difference comes the power of unity. When I look around the room, I see so many of us who are in caring professions, whether they're your social workers or frontline workers, counselors, pastors, nurses, and more. One thing I've consistently heard from these folks in these professions is that when caring for the people in front of them, it takes time to build relationship and trust. In practices of compassion and solidarity with the communities they serve, there's an acknowledgement that those they help might not even want assistance, companionship, or care. But by practicing presence and empathy and patience, transformative relationships happen over time. Solidarity with others doesn't happen immediately, nor do the results of it necessarily even become noticeable over time. And so committing to the long haul of this work invites us into the nitty-gritty of relationship, where we can slowly build towards resilient communities. And so finally, let's look at the heart of our story here with Jesus. Beaten physically and brokenhearted emotionally, Jesus literally cannot carry his cross. This is a stark contrast to our Savior, who proclaims in the beginning of this book, in Luke 4, that the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight of the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. How does he get here? Well, after Jesus proclaims this exact prophecy of hope in Luke 4, he gets driven out of town and almost thrown off a cliff. And so what we see in the Gospels is this growing tension between Jesus and the powers that be, who are waiting in the wings to resist, persecute, and eventually plot to kill him. But despite these real threats, Jesus goes about his work. He heals the sick. He casts out demons. He subverts social hierarchy and challenges the religious order to include Romans, women, the poor, and children. And so the path of Jesus the Liberator that Luke paints then is two parallel roads. So one road of liberation and freedom, and then one of resistance and impending suffering. The two actually go hand in hand in this gospel. Wonder if we can take a hold of that paradox for a moment. For a God who has the whole world in their hands, why does Jesus subject himself to extreme lengths of pain? Why does God choose to become human and endure heartbreak? Why does he live poorly and subject himself to oppressive rule and ultimately to face death? I think it's because Jesus is so overwhelmingly moved to act. He comes because he is driven by compassionate love. God does not abandon her creation in suffering, God chooses to become a part of it and to liberate it as one of us. Jesus becomes the image of co-suffering and solidarity. When we wonder where God is in the suffering of the world, in this city, or even our own lives, Jesus's answer is that he's always been there. He is with the oppressed. He is with the marginalized. He is with the brokenhearted. He is with the lonely. He is there. Ultimately, Jesus on the cross shows that those who suffer are not alone in their pain. In response to our suffering, Jesus' response is to suffer with us and even to die for us and with us. He chooses to share in our pain as solidarity. This is why Paul writes in Philippians 2 that Jesus empties himself as God, becoming human and embodying servanthood and taking on suffering all the way to the cross. God doesn't just sympathize with the hurt and broken. The God of the universe becomes a sufferer himself to fully identify with the sufferers of the world. In living into divine solidarity, the Creator commits to the most radical act of love. So in Jesus the Sufferer, we see that the contrasting roads of liberation and suffering are one. When we choose to stand with the marginalized and oppressed, I think there's also a resistance that will inevitably come. And so for us as followers of Jesus, I think it means for us to be prepared to take this road too. So this brings us to our third point, that true solidarity comes at a cost. It is the heart of the gospel to fight for shalom, but that doesn't mean that it will be easy. In the practice of co-suffering, we have to give up our voices as central and choose to listen to others. We must give up individualism and choose to embrace our neighbor. We might need to give up funds to mutual aid or donate time to go volunteer or go march. We will also be weary as we grieve with those who are grieving. Regardless of how we go about solidarity, there is a sacrifice. And this cost of discipleship is one that Jesus asks of each and every one of us as we join him in the work of co-suffering. The work of solidarity, though, it sounds intimidating. And the point is that it is. It's scary to go down this road of adversity with Jesus, not knowing how we will come out on the other end. But holding this tension of the cost of solidarity, I also want to see that with sacrifice comes life. Norman Wiersbe writes, "Christian sacrifice is about learning how to make one's life into a gift that creates communion." So when we frame sacrifice in this lens, we see that the work of solidarity is never about us as individuals, but about relationship, mutuality, friendship, community, joy, and hope. It creates life. We do this sacrificial work because we believe that there's a better way to live together than the current status quo. And that is worth fighting for. Farmer and writer Wendell Berry writes, "The living can't quit living because the world has turned terrible and people they love and need are killed. They can't because they don't. The light that shines in darkness and never goes out calls them on into life. It calls them back into the great room. It calls them into their bodies and into the world, into whatever the world will require. It calls them into work and pleasure, goodness and beauty, and the company of other loved ones." So, we don't do the hard work of solidarity in vain. We do so because ultimately, the cross is not the final word. The resurrection is. Because of the resurrection, we see that there is life after death. We see that the power of empire is ultimately overcome by the power of sacrificial love. We see that the journey to shalom is a struggle we're struggling for. We may never see the full fruit of our labor in this life, but the mystery of the resurrection tells us that our efforts will be revealed when Jesus restores all things. So I look around this room again, and I see artists, peacemakers, teachers, and caretakers. I see activists, scholars, and justice workers. As Martin Luther King says, we are caught up in this web of mutuality. And as we lean into the work of solidarity together, we truly do need each and everyone here. We need educators and organizers. We need those who have done this work for decades to tell us stories of hope and grief. We need eager and ready hands. We need artists to communicate beauty and pain. We need people to be a compassionate presence. We need those who will grieve, and we need those who will point us to joy. It can be hard to imagine leaning into the struggle alone. We need to know that there's others who are similarly connected, because we can only do so much alone and persist alone for so long. So here's an opportunity that we want to share with you all. So Artisan is going to be hosting a dialogue circle on Palm Sunday evening on April 13th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. We're calling it a gathering for aching visionaries. Anyone who would like to come is invited. We sense that many at Artisan embody this description of aching visionaries, those who grieve what is unjust and want to imagine what could be. So on this night, we'll share our longings, our angers, our mournings, and our best wisdom on how to stay engaged in this moment of disorientation. If you are weary, frustrated, or grief-filled at the instability of our time, there might be something for you. So Black theologian James Cone writes, "A symbol of death and despair, God turned the cross into a sign of liberation and new life. The cross is the most empowering symbol of God's loving solidarity with the least of these, the unwanted in society who suffer daily from great injustices." So what does Jesus do in response to human suffering and oppression? He responds by suffering with us, dying on the cross, and sharing in our pain as an act of loving witness and solidarity in the hope of new life and creation's collective liberation. And we are invited to respond to Jesus by following this costly road of discipleship. We do so by giving our tears, practicing neighborliness, and choosing to embody the Jesus way of sacrifice as we work for shalom in our neighborhoods and cities. So as we come to the table now, we are invited to this road with Jesus, receiving his body and his blood in the face of suffering and seeing it as a gift of new life. By taking communion, we say yes to the upside down reality of the cross and are called by Jesus to the long haul journey of solidarity by giving our own body and blood to others as we go wherever we're called to, as he has done to us.